Presently, Sergeant Coke, a fair-haired, pleasant-mannered young man, drifted into conversation with me. "There's a lot of dead Bosch along here, sir," he said cheerfully. This roused my interest, for curiously enough, though I'd been 6 months' service in France and had often seen men hit, it had always been in well-ordered trenches where casualties were soon disposed of, and I'd never seen a corpse. "Come along, sir," said Sergeant Coke, leading the way over holes and hummocks of chalk. When we were up at Messines, they lay about thick. I pulled the teeth out of one of them and made a necklace out of them. All the chaps used to rummage around there for souvenirs. "Careful, sir. Look out for this wire." "Look at this, sir," gloated Sergeant Coke. This, as he said, was a tangle of rusted brown wire, a framework of stakes and barbed wire of the kind which soldiers call a knife rest. It had been struck by a 60-pound trench mortar bomb, of which the stem lay close by. In the middle of the tangle, as if the wires had been carefully twisted round it, was a bundle of rags. They were grey and of fine texture, like my own khaki, obviously the ruins of an officer's uniform. It was only when I noticed two smartly booted and gaitered legs in tan leather protruding from one end of the bundle that I realised it was anything more than rags. No other sign of humanity was visible. I thought of that smart German subaltern, a man perhaps very like me, crawling carefully over his parapet, as I very often had to crawl over mine to see how the wire was withstanding the British drum fire. There was a patch of shadow under the knife rest where he could lie unobserved. Then the barrage fell in thunders and lightnings. The air was full of reeking smoke and whining fragments of steel. He would try to crawl back as the British bombardment was directed on his belt of wire, but the 60-pounder fell and killed him in a thicket of iron thorns unseen. But Sergeant Coke was enjoying himself. "There's some good ones over here," he said, "in the big crater. Come on." I went fascinated. There were several men standing about making little fires of splintered wood, for the morning was too thick to give the enemy a view of us. Two or three were looking into the mine crater when we reached it. This was not the glory hole, the great crater at Laboisel, nor the equally great one on the Bapaume Road, but a small 15-foot hollow among many shell holes. In the bottom of it were lying two curious things. They were muddy grey in colour, clothes and boots and faces. They had features, but features swollen till the skin was stretched tight over their brows and noses and cheekbones. They lay not in picturesque attitudes, but in the stiff, unreal pose of fallen tailors' dummies. They looked less human than waxworks. All the personality had faded from their faces. Big men they had been. Now they had a horrid plumpness. In awful fact, they were bursting out of their clothes. I felt neither afraid nor unhappy, but fascinated. These things were less like men than the friendly earth to which they were returning. They were unclean. I returned satisfied. I'd seen a corpse. Now, to me, that's a horrific an account written by an officer, Charles Carrington, serving with the Royal Warwickshires during the Battle of the Somme in July of 1916. But it portrays what we can't possibly imagine or see in our own mind's eye, the true reality of the dead, killed by weapons designed in this first fully industrial war. And it makes us realise that when we visit those beautiful cemeteries on the Somme, at Ypres and beyond, that in the sandbags beneath the headstones, quite often, there's only partial remains of these men, hurriedly buried, exhumed again after the war and then buried again in the concentration cemeteries like Sayre Road No. 2 and Tynecott. What we see above ground betrays what lies beneath the ground, and it certainly betrays the circumstances in which these poor men of all nations died. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, and it really is this week, because it's that man, Charles Carrington, that we're going to follow. during his time on the Somme in the summer, the autumn of 1916 and into the spring of 1917. So who was Charles Carrington? Well, he was born in April 1897 at West Bromwich in the West Midlands, and he signed up for war in 1914 at the age of 17, and he found himself commissioned into the 1st 5th Territorial Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. And during his service in the war, he served on both the Western Front and the Italian fronts, and he was awarded the Military Cross. Now, he published two memoirs, what we're going to feature in this week's podcast. The first he called A Subaltern's War, and that was what I was reading at the start of the podcast. He published that under a pseudonym, Charles Edmonds, and that came out in 1929. And then as late as 1964, so some 50 years after he signed up, he wrote another book, Soldier from the Wars Returning. Now, as well as the two books, he also gave an interview to the BBC in the 1960s. And this is what he said was his experience of the first day of that great battle, the 1st of July, 1916.
I got up at dawn in the morning. I was acting adjutant of my battalion on the morning of the 1st of July, and I went up to take to my command post in the trenches from which we could see over the country between Gomcourt and Serre. And when I got there, here were messages coming in from the front companies to say that they were all in order and that everything was right. We tested our lines back to the artillery. And I can only say that I have never been so excited in my life. This was like a boy going to the play for the first time in his life. And this is indeed what it was. And the noise rose to a crescendo such as I'd never heard before, for which we, for the first time, used the word drum fire, which is a great description of it. A noise which made all bombardments that we'd heard in the previous days seem like nothing at all. And the effect of the bombardment created a sort of hysterical feeling. And at zero, I sent back a message to brigade headquarters to say that we were all ready and were going to deliver our smoke cloud. And then at the moment, we could see the outburst of smoke and gas from our front line driving, blowing in the right direction towards the Germans. And then somebody shouted, "There they go." And I looked over to the left, and here were the London Scottish, who were on our left, running forward across the 300 or 400 yards of green grass between our village and Gomcourt Wood. And then they vanished into the smoke, and then there was nothing left but noise. And after this, we saw nothing and we knew nothing. And we lived in a world of noise, and simply noise, for hours.
Seems incredible that he was so optimistic, being part of that diversionary attack on Gomacor, which we featured a few weeks ago in a podcast with Beth Moore, and the horror, the decimation that was to occur over the next few hours. What comes through from Carrington is that he was such a proud and patriotic man. At no stage does he criticise the British government or the senior command. And going back to his book, A Subaltern's War, he talks about going up to the front line a few days after the battle had begun. Halt at La Boisselle had been our orders. Take the turn in half right at the crossroads and halt at the first house on the left, a white cottage. We came at the bottom of the valley into a new country. It was a desert of broken chalk, ditches, holes, craters, mounds and ridges, dry and thinly overgrown with weeds, and all interlaced with rusty strands of wire. The road vanished in this waste, hard by a great mountain of gleaming white chalk on our left. He then goes on to explain what it was like to come under artillery fire, enemy artillery fire. This is at this point, quite unexpectedly, a 4.2 howitzer shell came jubilantly sailing over and crashed into the chalk beside us with an air of almost human satisfaction at having surprised us. There was a little waver among the ranks, for we were getting lost and the march was suffering yet another check. Then came another shell falling closer, a crescendo of sound rising to a high note as it reached the top of its trajectory, falling as it came near to a low, sibilant roar. It burst with a crash and a buzz of flying splinters. Close by, and we cowered into shell holes and under banks. Then shells came over one by one at regular intervals. It began to dawn on me that the head of the column must be in La Boisselle, and that was our objective. When I read this, it seems incredible. I've been to La Boisselle so many times over the last 25 years, and indeed, as people know, our billet that we stay at, number 56, Bed and Breakfast, is in La Boisselle on that main road that he talked about. It's now such a quiet, peaceful village like they all are on the Somme. It seems incredible that there was such horror being experienced by these young men in a place that we now spend so many happy times. Drinking, eating, chatting about our own lives, chatting about the war with other people that are interested, all at the same time, maybe sitting upon the graves of British, French and German soldiers yet to be discovered. One of the other officers that was there was a man called Bickersteth. And he says, "Where's this village they talk of?" I asked him. "What's happened to La Boisselle?" "This is it, look. I'll show you where we are on the map." "Then where are the Boche now?" asked I, looking vaguely towards the east. "No wonder we couldn't find the village last night. And indeed, the very lines of trees that flanked the road had been blown out of existence. The only landmark was a high rim of white chalk, like the crater of a volcano, 50 yards in diameter, just where the road vanished." "Look at that mine crater," I said. Bickersteth said, "Far as I can make out, this is the old German front line in front of La Boisselle." "Then that," he pointed to a straggly line of orchard trees half a mile away across a low valley, "must be Auvillay. The Boche are still there. What he's doing is looking across the original no man's land from the 1st of July, a few days before, where hundreds, perhaps thousands of men from the 8th Division had been cut down on the 1st of July. And then on the 3rd of July, men from the 12th Eastern Division had also floundered as they cross what's perhaps 800 yards of no man's land, the widest stretch of no man's land, on the 1st of July 1916, as they tried to get to the ruined village of Auvillay through a hail of machine gun bullets. That was Auvillay that they were looking at, still occupied by the Germans. Carrington then goes on to talk about his fear and unease as he and Bickersteth are summoned to headquarters to get orders that they were to attack the village of Auvillay, but not this time front on, as had happened several times in the last week or so, but from the rear, an operation in itself that was full of dangers. Carrington says, "I found the CO already poring over a map and talking to a ring of officers clustered round, their faces alone illuminated by the light of a candle on the dugout table. 'Is that everyone, Hayward?' asked the CO. 'Yes, sir.' 'Right. We're going to do a little attack tonight. Our objective is the crossroads behind Auvillay. Better look at it on my map. It's the best. Can you see, Suckling? Right. We've got to get there at 1 o'clock a.m. It'll be difficult. Jumping off place is a line drawn from point 66 at right angles to the main road.' He talked on as quietly as if he were giving operation orders for manoeuvres. I could hardly listen. A tremendous sense of realisation came over me. I hardly know if it were fear or excitement. I just knew what to do. Attacks I was familiar with, but they were attacks over known ground against imaginary enemies. Fighting I knew, but it was fighting dream battles with visionary foes. That had been a favourite game since I played at fighting the Boers in the nursery. For the very first time I thought what it meant, to struggle for life with a man of equal wit and training. Not all the strain of 6 months' trench warfare, all the ordeal of July the 1st, all the last 2 days of preparation had told me what this meaning of war, and in a dream I wrote notes of the plan. The battalion would form here in two waves, would wheel half left here, would march by this line on the left, and would extend an assault here." There he is, talking about as a boy, perhaps playing boy soldiers, going through months of training, being on the front line, being on the Western Front for several months before now. But this is it. This is the real thing. They were going to attack the German army in all its might. at Ovillers. A wild hope seized me. The second in command was usually left behind. That was myself. Was it a hope or was it a fear? Something in me wished to go with the battalion. But no, he was chosen by the colonel to be in the attack. The colonel said, "We'll put Carrington to watch the directing flank." For a second time, I was smitten helpless with fear. Then as quickly, it vanished, and I found myself, to my own amazement, taking orders in detail as impassively as the colonel gave them. I was to lead the left flank along an old cable trench. I was to cross the first trench I came to and take, hold and fortify with No. 8 Platoon the trench junction on the crossroads. Now, I know this area very well at Ovillers. Can see it from No. 56, bed and breakfast, out of the window upstairs. Not far away is where my own great-uncle was mortally wounded a few weeks later. And about 20 years ago, I actually stayed with some friends in a property on the edge of Ovillers, near the crossroads that he's talking about on the east side of Ovillers. Those crossroads are still there. I was aware of this action by Carrington. In fact, I had this book that I'm reading from now with me. We spent, I think it was 2 nights in that house. The German defences that he's talking about I worked out from my trench map. Part of it was in the garden of this house we were staying in. Carrington goes on to say that the colonel finished with a stony look. "There will be no retiring," he said. "On no conditions whatsoever is any man to turn back. Let them all understand that." Carrington then goes on to describe the attack, which took place just 2 hours after they'd received their instructions. He says, "When the time came for the assembly of the companies along the lines of hollows in the chalk, I was surprised how little I felt afraid. One little incident reassured me still more. An NCO came up and said that Private Elliot wished to speak to me. The man was a mere boy whom I'd known in England, and I felt flattered that he should apply to me for help, for whatever help I could give. I found him crouched against a chalk heap, almost in tears. He looked younger than ever. 'I don't want to go over the plonk,' he flung at me in the shamelessness of terror. 'I'm only 17. I want to go home.' The other men standing around avoided my eye and looked rather sympathetic and disgusted. 'Can't help that now, my lad. You should have thought of that when you enlisted. Didn't you give your age as 19? "Yes, sir, but I'm not. I'm only, well, I'm not quite 17, really, sir." "Well, it's too late now," I said. "You'll have to see it through, and I'll do what I can for you when we come out." I slapped him on the shoulder. "You'll be with the others. You'll be all right when you get started. This is the worst part of it, this waiting. And, well, none of us are enjoying it. Come along now, jump to it." And he seemed to take heart again. And this incident served to restore my spirits at least. And I found the numb spot in my midriff almost gone. It was almost 9:30 and I was almost enjoying the feeling of responsibility when the long column began to file over the shell holes through the dusk. But that walk became a nightmare. I was at the tail of the company, which moved for hours through broken trenches in a single file. Handily, in the book on page 89, Carrington has included a diagram of the route that they took. And it shows them going parallel with the main road that runs along between Albert and Bapaume through the village of La Boisselle, passing what was then the Weissach crater, mine crater, on the left, and then turning off of the main road, going through and out of the village of La Boisselle, and then once again crossing that main road. And their attack would then turn left or back towards the west and advance against the Germans close to a trench called Sickle Trench. One thing that I've just realised when I read this account, when Carrington was, shall we say, motivating that young lad who wasn't yet 17, was that himself, as an officer, was just 19 years old and 3 months. To me and you, that's a boy. In military terms, he's very much a man. He describes the journey as it continues. Presently, we climbed out of the trench and hurried over a grassy slope that had been little shelled where there was a light railway. Now and then, we passed salvage equipment and once or twice a corpse lying sprawled by the way. The battalion was already straggling out in the effort to reach that hopeless rendezvous in time. It became harder and harder to keep up the pace with these tired and heavily laden men. Then we came out onto a road that ran along the top of a spur. The high bank on its further side was honeycombed with little shelters dug in the mud, where snoring figures slept huddled under muddy ground sheets. He says, at one point we came out on the main road, wide and clear and empty, flanked with shattered trees, and then we went down again into the longest trench of all, where the few occupants were men of the 17th Battalion. Here, though we never knew it, we were right amongst the enemy, and in danger of counterattack from almost any side. This sickle trench was a long curving line that led straight out towards Ovillers from the furthest point of our advance line. The pace was now getting quicker than ever. The companies in rear had dropped right out of hearing, and I was feeling desperate when suddenly I came round a traverse, face to face with Thorn of D Company, who was pushing and lifting the last man before me, gun, ammunition, and all, out onto the parapet. "Hello, laddie," he said cheerfully enough, and I felt amongst friends again. But before there was time for explanation, he hustled me too out into no man's land, with a clap on the back and his blessing. I found myself now in a long slope of rough grass, knee-high entangled, in sight, after all, of what looked like the battalion. Here was the Sergeant Major, stumping on his game leg, blarneying the sections into place with his stick, with all the gestures, if not the noise, of the parade ground. But the men were so tired that I found some waiting in their places who'd fallen asleep here in no man's land. And then we were over the top. We went on in the dark, breaking now and then into the double. The exhilaration of that rush of men was wonderful. The first two waves, barely 15 yards apart, bunched until the sections were almost shoulder to shoulder. The bayonets gleamed in the flashes of the barrage that crashed in front of us. It seemed unbelievable that this torrent of men could sweep upon the enemy unseen. Down the hill, on, not a shot was fired. Now, where the ground sloped up again, we were thrown into a mass. Someone cried, "Extend!" And the men threw themselves forward, running over shell holes even closer together. I was no more afraid than if it was all a game. Only when the village was looming up, a black line of ruins and hedges against the dark sky, I glanced nervously, looking for the opening of that flanking machine gun fire. Surely they must have seen us. The ground was now torn and furrowed, ploughed into powdery chaos by the bombardment. A battered trench could only just be distinguished in their general ruin. We broke into a charge and someone behind me tried to cheer. We silenced him, but still no sign from the enemy. Over the empty trench and on. So much for the first objective. We struggled over mound and crater of spongy soil and reached the road. No sign from the enemy. Behind was a high bank. And over that I could see the very lights go up from the next German line. But the road was now a jumbled mass of panting men. Where was my objective? The crossroads were blasted out of existence. If that flattened ditch over which I jumped was my trench, then heaven help me when the machine guns fired down for the village on our left. "Get your sections in hand," I shout to every NCO. "And keep quiet, for God's sake." Then the expected happens. Crack, crack, crack goes the Bosch machine gun, shooting uneasily at this noise from a strange direction, shooting wildly but showing he had heard us. I think frenziedly, have we gone too far or not far enough? The soldier's motto is, when in doubt, go forward. The least, we cannot stay here and be shot down in the cutting. In this supreme moment, I was inspired. More and more men crowded onto the road, and half a dozen orders and warnings were bandied about. I drew my revolver and I scrambled at the bank. "Come on, lads," I shouted, "over the top." And for one ghastly moment, I stood there alone. It seemed that I was lifted out of myself and something in me that was cynical and cowardly looked down in a detached way at this capering little figure posing and shouting unrepeatable heroics at the men below. Through the cracking of the machine gun and the banging of the barrage, at last I made myself heard. "Forward! And we'll have the next trench too!" Then I became aware of a short, little, fat man standing beside me, brandishing a rifle and bayonet. With a common impulse, we turned and ran on towards the enemy. "Who are you?" I shouted. "I can't see you." "Don't you know me, sir? I'm the Sergeant Major's Batman." "Good man," said I. "I remember you for this." As we raced across the short 50 yards of grass, a trickle of men and then a rush followed us over the bank. Before us, we felt vaguely that there was commotion in the enemy's trench, and the very lights went up no more. We were now in the barrage which had seemed to go before us across the valley. I reached the edge of the trench, wondering vaguely what I should do if I found a German bayonet man poised in it to catch me as I jumped. But the bay was empty, and I landed on the firm floor of the trench, just as a shell burst with a metallic bang 10 or 15 yards away on my right. This was as good as fun as playing soldiers in the garden at home. I find that incredible, don't you? I suppose in that moment the adrenaline is rushing through his veins that this is what he means. In a minute there were 20 or 30 men behind me shouting and laughing as they skylarked around the traverses. Of course there was no officer or NCO handy. I began to think I was winning the Battle of the Somme alone. Then behind me I noticed the grey head of Corporal Turner, who always reminded me of Baloo in the Jungle Book. "I've got my six men here," he said rather plaintively. "We can't go for that machine gun over there, sir. It's miles away. The colonel told me to stick to you, sir, if we couldn't get at it." "Good for C Company," I shouted. "You're the only section that has stuck together. Take your men down the trench as far as you can to the left and make a bomb stop and hold that side." "Righto, sir." And off he went. Then I rushed along to the right. The Ray, the garrison, had retired, but there was no NCO to send to that flank. The trench was deep and wide, with sheer sides and a firm foot of clay. The traverses were 7 or 8 feet high, and then 10 feet thick. The shelling, which gradually slackened, was directed mostly to the right. That's a good description of the German trenches there. It must have come as quite a shock to them, of course, because the British trenches were only temporary. They were to be effectively jumping off positions from where to attack from, and they weren't built in the same strength, depth, as the German defences. The Germans, of course, were there to stay. They built these trenches 2 years before in 1914. They'd be built, not one, two, and even the third line of defences was being built a few miles away from where Carrington was. As far as the Germans were concerned, all the land to the east of where they were was theirs. Large chunks of France and most of Belgium, that was part of the German Empire. Carrington then talks about, along the trench, coming across one of those deep German dugouts. He says, "There was a dugout shaft right before us." "Will I throw a bomb down it, sir?" said one of his NCOs. "No," said I, feeling full of beans. "I'm going down to have a look. Don't let anyone throw a bomb down after me." The sergeant didn't approve. But I called to Lee, a smart-looking lad who was close by, and we started down the shaft. Lee giggled. "Lee," said I, "have you got an electric torch?" "No, sir, but I got a match somewheres." So I lit a match and held it well away from me. We crept down the stairway, I with the match and a revolver, he with a bayonet and the giggles. The dugout opened to the left at the foot of some 20 steps. I slid my revolver muzzle round the corner, gingerly showing the light. 6 inches from my hand was the corner of a table on which half a loaf of bread, some tin meat, and there was just by my hand an electric torch. I grabbed it and illuminated the dugout. Thank God there was no one there. It was bigger, cleaner and more comfortable than the one at La Boisselle, and consisted of a corridor lined with rows of bunks joining two small square chambers from each of which a shaft led up to the trench. The walls were all panelled and lined with a double row of bunks on which lay blankets ruffled from recent use. A grey coat or two hung on the walls, and joy there were 5 pickle barrels lying around. Joy, he says, well, this is one of the most prized possessions that a British soldier could take back as a souvenir. He said evidently the Boche had been surprised and run, leaving food, blankets and equipment behind. And no wonder, if they'd heard the battalion yelling and swarming over their trenches from the rear. It's incredible, isn't it, when you listen to that description there of what those enormous German dugouts look like. And to think that they're still there as we wander around La Boisselle and Auvillay and those other once ruined, now rebuilt villages. Beneath our feet is not just the trenches, but those enormous dugouts that the Germans had built to make them safe from the week-long artillery bombardment that preceded the great push on the 1st of July. Carrington then discovered from his colonel had turned up they'd actually gone too far. Darkness was fading into dawn, and dawn into a damp and misty daylight. And what happens then when you're fighting the German army in the First or the Second World War? The same thing happens, always happens, when the Germans lose some ground. They counterattack. They counterattack usually with different soldiers that are specially trained for counterattack. The men who've been forced from those positions are out of the line. The men to try and take back the lost ground are fresh troops up against tired British soldiers. A different challenge for Carrington and his men. There was a sound as of someone scuttling up the trench. Why, it must have been the jolly old Boche. We'd sent the A Company men back and organised our own men with sentries on the flanks and a reserve platoon in the dugout and were feeling safe and happy. When again I heard something on the right. Stand to, there was a shout. They're coming. My servant and another man who'd been hanging about beyond the sentry post came flying round the traverse. Allerman, he said. They're coming. This was a different matter from running about in noise and darkness. I suddenly thought of Prussian guardsmen, burly and brutal, and bursting bombs and hand-to-hand struggles with cold steel. Thud went a loud noise along the trench, and the air shook and whined with flying fragments. I felt myself turning pale. I found I was walking slowly away from the danger point. I must go and tell Bickersteth. I excused myself. I passed the word down the dugout. Then I pulled myself together and got up to the front somehow. The men, too, were very panicky. Poor devils. They hadn't had a good sleep or a square meal for 3 days. Thud went a bomb 3 bays up the trench. I licked my lips and felt for my revolver. Thud went a bomb 2 bays away. Come along, let's get back to the bomb stop, said I, not very bravely. We were at a traverse 2 bays further on where there was a sentry post. Just then, round the traverse and the dugout came Sergeant Adams, an old volunteer of many years' service in England. He was smoking a pipe and had a thin smile on his face. "What's that, sir?" he said pleasantly. "Go back." "No, sir, let's go forward." And he tucked his rifle under his arm and strolled along the trench alone, still smiling. A bomb burst in the bay behind him. He climbed the traverse and took a snapshot with his rifle at some person beyond. A group of men stood wavering. And then I went and took my place beside him on the traverse. 30 or 40 yards away, I saw a hand and a grey sleeve come up out of the trench and throw a cylinder on the end of a wooden rod. It turned over and over in the air and seemed to take hours to approach. It fell just at the foot of the traverse where we stood and burst with a shattering shock. What he's talking about there is a German hand grenade with the explosives on different to British bombs, which, you know, the pineapple-shaped Mills bombs. These German bombs had wooden handles, which they threw like this man did. And the British called them potato mashers. Carrington went on. He said, the next one will get us, I thought. Sergeant Adams pulled a bomb out of his pocket and threw it. A young Lance Corporal Houghton did the same. The next German bomb fell short. then someone threw without remembering to pull the pin, and in a moment the bomb was caught up and thrown back at us by the enemy. I snapped off my revolver once or twice at glimpses of the enemy. Adams and Houghton had gone forward now, and I was just watching them over the traverse when I had the impression that someone was throwing stones. Suddenly I saw lying in the middle of the trench a small black object, about the shape and size of a large duck's egg. There was a red band round it and a tube fixed in one end of it. In a flash, I guessed it must be a new sort of bomb. In fact, what it was indeed the first use in action of what they called a German egg bomb, which could be thrown much further than the ordinary stick bomb. But Carrington said it was far less dangerous when it exploded. He says it was lying less than a yard from my foot. I was right in the corner of the trench. What was I to do? In an instant of time, I thought, had I the nerve to pick it up and throw it away? Should I step over it and run, or stay where I was? There was no room to lie down. But too late. The bomb burst with a roar at my feet. My eyes and nose were full of dust and pungent fumes. Not knowing if I was wounded or not, I found myself stumbling down the trench with a group of groaning men. One man, Alan, was swearing and shouting in a high-pitched voice and bleeding in the leg. All the nerve was blasted out of us. My clothes were a little torn. My hand was bleeding, but that was all. "You must get these men together, Carrington," Bickersteth was saying, "and make a counterattack." "I'm damned if I will," said I. "I'm done for." And I lay and panted. He looked at me and saw I was useless. I hadn't an ounce of grit left in me. It was Wells who collected the remnants and went up again to find my revolver. "Shamefully cast away in the presence of the enemy," said Sergeant Adams, still holding his own. "Come on, Carrington," said Bickersteth, and I came. In a minute or two, I felt better and went up. We got the Lewis gun out and the whole party moved forward. Houghton was throwing well. We rushed a bay, and Houghton, who was leading, found himself face to face with a German officer the length of the next bay between them. He threw a lucky bomb, which burst right in the German's face. Their leader fallen, the heart went out of the enemy's attack. At the same moment, there were two diversions. An 8-inch shell, one of those which had been falling occasionally on our right, suddenly landed right in the bay behind the German bomber, and his supporters fled, so ended their attack. But as we moved forward, a sniper fired almost from behind us. I felt the bullet crack in my ear, and Corporal Matthews, who was walking beside me, preoccupied and intent, fell dead in the twinkling of an eye. I was looking straight at him as the bullet struck him and was profoundly affected by the remembrance of his face, though at the time I hardly thought of it. He was alive, and then he was dead, and there was nothing human left in him. He fell with a neat, round hole in his forehead and the back of his head blown out. What he's talking about there is the entry and exit wound. Other big shells followed the first, so we decided not to hold that part of the trench. We propped up the dead Boche as a warning to his friends against the furthest traverse and set to work on a better bomb stop behind, just where Corporal Matthews was hit. Ironic, really, isn't it? Because at the start of the podcast, Carrington was talking about seeing what was left of German casualties on the Somme battlefield, and he said he'd never seen a corpse before. Well, now he has. It's a corpse of one of his own NCOs, that Corporal Matthews. I wonder whether in the book A Subaltern's War, Carrington had changed the name of his colleagues that he's talking about, his comrades that he's talking about, because I've had a look on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. I can't find any trace of a Corporal Matthews from the Royal Warwickshires having died at this stage of the battle with this battalion. Having then taken their objectives and fought off a counterattack, it was then down to the men to fortify their positions in case the Germans attacked again. He said, "We must level one traverse flat and have a field of fire longer than the range of the German stick bomb." Almost as we approached and cut into it with pickaxes, the same sniper fired again from the village on our left, and a man called Pratt dropped like a stone just where the corporal had fallen, he too had a small round hole in his temple and the back of his skull blown away. No one seemed very anxious to take his place on the bomb stop. The body was moved down the trench and we stood around, cutting gingerly into the pile of earth. I myself stood opposite the parapet gap through which the sniper fired and took care not to expose myself too much. We seemed to do very little good. "Ah, give me that pick! Let me get at it!" suddenly roared one man, and he sprang up the traverse all exposed, striking giant blows that loosened the top of the mound where no one dared to work. It was Jimmy Mills, and his time was short. For 15 seconds, perhaps, he panted and drove his pick mightily, loosening the stiff clay before the sniper fired again. Mills flung wide his pick and collapsed with a loud cry, inarticulate with rage and pain. The bullet had struck him in the left hip and pierced his bowels from side to side, emerging from the right. "That's a third man dead," thought I. There were now two men dying on the trench floor. Pratt, beating with helpless hands on the earth, the blood gushing from his nostrils, and now Mills, the old soldier, conscious and groaning, his soldiers soaked with blood, thrilled with agony by every touch, by every movement. The other men, wounded earlier in the counter-attack, had been taken down into the dugout. These two more I brought to die in comfort in the deep, safe fire bay above it. Pratt was hopeless, hitting the same place as Matthews. His head was shattered. Splatterings of brain lay in the pool of blood under him. But though he had never been conscious since the shot was fired, he refused to die. Old Corporal Welsh looked after him, held his body and arms, which writhed and fought feebly as he lay. It was over 2 hours before he died. Hours of July sunshine in a crowded space where perhaps a dozen men sat in a ditch 10 yards long and 5 feet wide, reeking with the smell of blood, while all the time above the soothing voice of the corporal, a gurgling and a moaning came from his lips, now high and liquid, now low and dry, a death rattle fit for the most bloodthirsty of novelists. Old Mills, tough, bronze, ginger moustache and 41 years old, lay beside this text. No stretcher bearers had come on my wild adventure last night, but the old soldier thought it best to leave him roughly bandaged until the inward wounds should close, that he might have a chance. He was little, but hardened by 14 years soldiering and 2 previous wars. His work had not been in vain. The men at the traverse would be fully occupied in digging away the soil which had loosened till dark, when someone could climb on top again. The day wore on. No more Germans came, but squalls of shrapnel swept the valley behind us and bombs thudded in the rear where we thought A Company should be. I got some sleep in the afternoon. There was no bunk empty, but I flung myself on a stretcher by the side of Lee. And then he thinks about what they've achieved. The village of Ovillers had been twice attacked in front and twice successfully defended by the Prussian Guard. We'd done more than this. We'd advanced and placed ourselves in a trench behind the German stronghold, cutting it off from support and almost surrounding it. But at the same time, we had now isolated ourselves, with Germans in front and behind us, the garrison of Ovillers in front, and those who were trying to relieve it behind. Consequently, we were exposed to fire from almost any direction. On the other hand, to look for help, we must turn back across the 1,000 yards of rough grass, impassable by day, which we had rushed across by night. We had little cause for worry that day. The long silence came to Pratt at last. Mills, game and grumbling, got a little maudlin and was less in pain. We all began to suffer from thirst. Our water bottles, of course, had been filled at starting, but fighting is dry work. It was a muggy day, and fear parches the throat. Most of us managed to hoard a few drops of water in case the ration party should not reach us. And there they stayed, until evening came again. Carrington says, with dusk came a renewal of activities. rearrange reliefs and the dugouts and put new life into the work on the bomb stop. But a shower of rain, darkness and the flash of explosions before and behind and the uncertainty of night made strained nerves even less reliable. And there was a disposition to panic. Every time I dozed off, when I was below, I was roused in a few moments by a hoarse whisper down the shaft. "Stand to, they're coming!" No need to ask who was coming. Up the steps we ran, heart in mouth and weapons in hand, time after time to find that the sentry had mistaken bursting shells for another bombing attack, or that a party of men was approaching from other companies, for under the cloak of darkness we'd regained touch with the world. "Stand to, they're coming!" No, this time it was a thrice welcome ration party with jars of rum and bully and biscuit for tomorrow. "But water," we ask. "Where is the water, man?" "Come in, sir. The sergeant major's bringing it. And bombs and ammo." So to sleep again. "Stand to, they're coming!" Again I fling myself up the shaft, for it is death to be trapped in the cellars by an enemy with bombs on the surface. "Who the hell are you?" the sentry gasps, his finger on the trigger and his aim on an approaching shadow. "All right, my man," says the colonel's well-known voice, low and firm, but a little petulant. Carrington then asks the colonel whether they are to be relieved. The colonel gives him bad news, tells him that they'll be all right there. "This is a good trench, you've got good dugouts." And then comes that whisper again, stand to, they're coming again. What is it?" asks the colonel. "Damn them, they're all alike. Half-gotten weaklings, what's the panic about?" He gives orders. "This nonsense must stop. We must have some sleep down here. Carrington, don't let them disturb me." "Oh Lord, what's this?" Unknowingly, in the dark, he'd stepped on Mills, the man that was mortally wounded. He gives a loud groan. "Wounded man," say I. "His name's Mills." "Well, get him out of the way." "Are you badly hurt, Mills? I'm sorry, but they shouldn't have put you here." "Oh, it's all right, sir. I'm done for. 14 years soldiering, and they got me this time. Back seams all numb, sir. Can't get warm." Now, despite that accident, despite the colonel coming with no good news, at no stage does Carrington criticise him. He said that the colonel was his hero. He said, "I admired his clothes and his horsemanship and his incisive speech and the adventures he'd had in Africa and his masterly way of handling troublesome superior officers." As the colonel said, no relieving company came for them that night, and at dawn they were ready for another day of misery and more counterattacks. They were suffering badly from thirst. No water party ever arrived. And they'd gone to the corpses to take their water bottles for the wounded. And when they got there, those bottles were empty. Towards noon on that third day, old Mills, lying on the fire step, groaning only when jolted unavoidably in the narrow way, began to give up hope. He thought he was dying and he turned sentimental. Pluckily, feebly, as I passed, he tried to give me his blessing. I was a fine young gentleman and had always been a good officer to him. And if it hadn't been for me, it would have all been done for. I was most embarrassed and only with difficulty told him not to talk like that, for he was good for another 14 years soldiering. Neither of us believed what I was saying. I quietened him at last with a dash of brandy from my flask, for which the doctor cursed me handsomely later, for it might have killed him instead of sending him to sleep. One of the wounded men below lost his nerve a little and moaned for water, till we thought we'd had better send another volunteer. Yates was a surly, unsociable man, offered to go. He took several water bottles and came back with enough for the wounded, making a second journey safely with a companion. And the wounded were now satisfied. But eventually they were relieved. By this time, Ovilers had been taken, and it was through the village they went, and then they saw the battlefield that had been fought over, as I said earlier, at least twice in the first week of the battle. The slope was held by tangle after tangle of rusty barbed wire and irregular lines. But among the wire lay rows of khaki figures as they'd fallen to the machine guns on the crest. I did not know that twice in the fortnight before our flank attack, Had a division been hurled on that wire-encircled hill, and twice had it withered away before the hidden machine guns. The flies were buzzing obscenely over the damp earth. Morbid, scarlet poppies grew scantily along the white chalk mounds. The air was thick and heavy, with rank, pungent explosives and the sickly smell of corruption. "Come on," I shouted. "Let's get a move on. This is a bad place to be caught in." I hurried on under a culvert and out again up the next spur, but the men could hurry no more. Worn out when they started, overloaded with these awkward buckets, they could make no better place through mud and shell holes than up this rough slope. When we reached the top of the hill, there was no mistake about it. The Germans were barraging the crest with heavies and probably would counterattack. Here I lost my temper. It was a case of getting my men through or saving this wretched ammunition. We were 3/4 of a mile from the front line. I decided to disobey orders. 2 gunner officers were watching the artillery duel close by. I set the men to work dumping the stores in a convenient shell hole and ran back to the gunners. In great haste, I committed to their charge 1 Lewis gun and I forget how many magazines. One of them was, I believe, a colonel and looked surprised, but I waited for nothing and fled, shouting to my men to run down the trench until they got out of the barrage. Eventually, they were in comparative safety. He says, "At last we came out into an open valley in the dusk and moved across turf again, but it was turf scored by the hooves of many mules and worn into ruts by wagon wheels. Everywhere, columns of transport with the night's supply of food and ammunition was moving up, and batteries were changing positions. One had just had a horse killed, had cut it loose and left it there by the track. Asking our way, we drifted over a low hill and stumbled somehow into the lines of bivouacs and flanks that flanked the road outside Albert. More by luck than judgment, we reached our own officers' lines to find we'd been given up for lost. They met me as one returned from the dead, where the company messes were dining by candlelight off the ground. I was the hero of the moment. 200 yards from our camp was a 6-inch naval gun which fired every few minutes over our heads, not only jarring our nerves, but extinguishing every light in the camp at every blast. We slept that night in a closed-in gun emplacement of earth and hurdles. And then, on page 112, the account comes to an abrupt halt, as Carrington simply states the casualties that they had encountered during their stint at Offillet. Killed 3 officers, 45 other ranks. Wounded 5 officers, 76 other ranks. That means 8 officer casualties and 121 other ranks. He repeats that number, 129. That's about 1/4 of those who took part in this battle. A small proportion considering the rashness of the enterprise. On July the 17th, 1916, the official report simply said this. On our left flank in Offillet-la-Boisselle, where there has been continuous hand-to-hand fighting since July the 7th, we captured the remaining strongholds of the enemy, together with 2 officers and 124 guardsmen, who formed the remnants of its brave garrison. The whole village is now in our hands. Over the years, I've read that account over and over again. I've walked that ground many times, different stages in the year, at different times of the day. In that field, just to the east of Offillet, where they made their initial attack, I remember one year, just after the fields had been ploughed, about this time of year it was, walking across there and finding all sorts of debris from the battles that took place there, mainly shrapnel balls and bits of shrapnel from the shells that were fired. Maybe bits of those hand grenades that were thrown by the Germans at Carrington and his defenders. In front of me today, I've got pages and pages of notes that I was going to share with you from Charles Carrington's account, not just of this short action on the Somme, but of his other experiences through that winter of 1916 and 1917 and then at Passchendaele and beyond. And I was going to talk about what became of him after the war. But an hour's gone, and I've found that that hour we've spent just talking about that three-day action at Ovillers. Something that we've not done before, I've not read from a book like this before. It's so well written, it's so powerful, and to me, it gives one of the best accounts of what it must have been like to come face to face with not just the enemy, but your own fears. And that horrible feeling of losing men, shot through the head. Not only worrying, missing those men, but knowing that in a few seconds' time it could be you, writhing in agony on the floor of a trench, crying out for mum, lost to the ground that you're trying to fight for. And in the shadow of that place, Ovillers, is the Tietvel Memorial, where many of those men that died that night are remembered. There is a large cemetery on the west side of Ovillers, and it's a cemetery that we're going to dedicate a whole episode of this podcast to. And no doubt some of the men that died that night are buried there. But we're going to leave it there this week so that you too, like me, can reflect on those words of Charles Carrington in that short book, Subaltern's War. It's easily obtainable, I believe, from all the usual places, but don't forget, he used the pseudonym of Charles Edmonds to write this book. And we're going to return again to his recollections of the Great War and see what else we can learn from one of the greatest writers and historians, in my view. I hope you've enjoyed, once again, this episode of my podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. And if you have, please do rate and review it wherever you download it from. It really does make a difference, not just to me, but helps spread the word to other people around the world. It helps them. It gives them a chance to understand and listen to the words of these men that are now gone. And I think it's only right that this week, once again, we play the last post in memory of those men from the 1st 5th Battalion of the Royal Warwickshires that died in this attack near Ovillers on the Somme in 1916. Mm-hmm.